And now it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art, with your hosts, David Von Strong and Leslie M. Scott Jones. And now, here's David and Leslie. Every day I'm moving further
from sobriety. Hello, Charlottesville, it is Sunday. It is 10 o'clock. It is June the 11th. It's going to be hot AF. And this is Homegrown, your local show about progressive art on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I am David Von Strong, a.k.a. the DVS1.
DVS!
And with you always, even via speakerphone, is the lovely, loquacious, lascivious Leslie M. Scott Jones via Galaxy S3 from Memphis. How you doing, girl?
I'm in Memphis. I'm is it good, picking up? Man. What's up?
Not a much. Not a much. Not a much. How is everything?
It's going well. You know, seriously, I was a little worried about being in a car with my mother and my daughter for 6 days, but,
understandable.
You know, I'm a couple days in. Everything's going all right.
Good.
You know, there have been no blow-ups.
Yet.
No blow-ups. Last night, we all flirted with the same bartender slash waiter.
The famed bartender?
Yeah, he was really cute.
I don't even want to know really what his fame was about.
I'm talking like Michael B. Jordan cute. That's how cute he was.
That's crazy to have like three generations of swoon like on you at the same time. That's
right.
That's crazy.
He really didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to handle it. But you know,
he's just trying to pay that rent. That's all that's about.
You know.
Perfect.
So I'm excited. I'm excited for this conversation.
Yeah, me too. Me too. We got a special show. We're cutting the banner short because we want to save all this meaty talk for our round table discussion, more like a square table, semi-scattered discussion. we have pillars of Charlottesville's art community. You might say, we have the brand new artistic director. Why are y'all laughing? I'm saying this is, y'all are awesome. Y'all are awesome. Get it right. So we have with us the new artistic director of Live Arts, Bree Luck, Boomy Pedersen, which is also the artistic director of the Hamner Theater. I know this. I just want to get it right. And Scott Dunn, who is also a playwright of Live Arts. Give him a round of applause. Yeah. Oh, my God. Scott Dunn, I love you. And they're with us here to have a special roundtable discussion about the extent of the playwright's role in production.
Yes.
The extent of the playwright's role in production.
So basically, I've used my masterpiece. What's happened is, first of all, we had Edward Albee's estate barring a production of one of his plays because the director chose to cast one of the actors as a black man instead of a white man. And basically resent the contract after this was discovered. So they had to concede to what the playwright originally intended. And then about a week and a half later, we had David Mamet forbid a talk back after one of his shows. And the same kind of thing happened. They had planned it, and then Mamet found out about it, resent a contract, and they had to re-sign it or they were going to pull the rights for the show. So this brings up several issues, not only colorblind or color-conscious casting, but also how much control should a playwright have over his work or her work being produced. So, Bree, I know that you actually you were planning to do an Albee piece at Live Arts this next season, so you contacted people and asked about this, right?
Yeah, I did. As soon as Facebook blew up with Streeter's email, with Streeter's post about the company in Oregon being denied the rights to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I contacted Samuel French to ensure that we could cast our production of A Delicate Balance, which is our season opener next year, any way that we see fit. And this is one of those times when it's a real advantage to be a community theater, because there are no casting restrictions on community theater productions of Albee's pieces. So we have casting freedom. We can cast it any way we want, which is good.
So were there already plans to color consciously or colorblind cast it?
You know, we are always talking, right? I mean, certainly since I've been at Live Arts, and I'm sure before too, we've had a lot of discussions about colorblind and color conscious casting. So it wasn't that we I hadn't met with the director yet, really, to talk about that. Fran Smith is directing that show, but we have had numerous discussions about using both colorblind and color conscious casting at Live Arts and how it might be used to affect. And she and I have had a few nominal discussions, but we are planning to have more as we get closer to casting the show. So we'll see. And we'll see who comes out for it, too.
So, Lemmy, I know that Hamner has always gone to great lengths to be color conscious when you cast shows and been really on the edge when you're doing especially Shakespeare, using the casting to bring something out of the show that people may not have seen. So what's your take on this?
Well, I really think this is where you have to consider the world that the playwright has created and whether what you're doing is trying to maintain that integrity or whether you're taking it and reinventing it to make sense today. And they are sometimes mutually exclusive. I mean, I think that you cannot take Raisin in the Sun, for instance, which has one white character and add white characters. You couldn't do that without denaturing the play. Same with August Wilson. And I think the same holds true for plays that have very specific milieu. And I think, for instance, A.R. Gurney's Wasp world is so that to change it would denature the play. So maybe we just don't do Gurney anymore because that world isn't reflective of the world we're living in now. So, I mean, I really think you have to figure out, why are you doing the play? What is the world of the play? And is that so integral to the play and the meaning of the play that you have to respect it? And I mean, it goes beyond just casting too. Like when Joanne Acolytis tried to set Endgame in a post-apocalyptic subway station, the Beckett estate shut that down because that was not the world Beckett had created. So now you're getting into, so what is the role of the playwright, especially posthumously, which I think is a interesting conundrum we're finding ourselves in now.
I just want to try. So I guess my kind of confusion about this is, as a playwright, and Scott, I'll ask you this question because you being, you know, first and foremost a playwright, I guess because it says playwright right here on the script that I'm holding.
Somebody put that down.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask you this.
Okay.
You write a show.
Yeah.
You put it out there for the people to grasp on, or for a director to direct and cast in its own way. Don't you relinquish a certain amount of creative control? And theater being a collaborative art, don't you have an obligation to accept that relinquishment?
That's a great word, relinquishment.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know if I would, that's not the first word that would come to mind for me, but what I would say is, The play is gonna live apart from me. So I can create something on the page, and I know it's gonna live somewhere else. And so I think that what hopefully what's going to happen is that there's going to be a conversation, and I would potentially, if I'm not dead anyway, get to talk to someone who's gonna put on that play and say, What is your thoughts on this? Are you considering casting apart from what I've written so far? I mean, what is the shape this play is going to take for you? And so, and yeah, maybe relinquish ultimately is the right word to say, is that, you know, you got to let it go at some point. You have to say, this is going to live and have a life of its own that I didn't necessarily foresee. It's going to be my vision, but it's also going to be somebody else's because it is the nature of theater. Mm-hmm. So if I create something, if I'm alone writing, ultimately sometime I get to collaborate with people and they're going to have different ideas than I will. And that's going to reshape that play in some ways. And if there are 10 different productions of that play, that's amazing. But every single one of them is going to have a different shape. And so it's going to be... that city or town or theater, the makeup of it, it's going to be reflective of that location, reflective of that environment. It's going to be something that they create as one company. Mm-hmm. And so, you let it go. It's going to take the shape that it gets. And I don't know if it's really, I'm not so stringent on some of the things that I create to say it absolutely has to be this way and no exceptions at all.
Right. But isn't that partly a reflection of the world we live in now? Because we're living in a world that is constantly changing and you can't help but be conscious of all the difference and embrace the difference. And that goes to producing contemporary plays as opposed to producing plays that were written in a specific time. Like, for instance, there was that whole shutting down of the Mikado because it was written by British men about Asian people and it was typically performed by white people in yellowface. So now we may never see another production of the Mikado unless it is done absolutely, authentically, ethnically. But the problem is that it reflected the time in which it was written, which was not the same as it is now. Mm-hmm. So do you want to portray that and send it up and say, look how it was then and isn't it different now? I mean, so it seems to me
I mean, it's like the same of like minstrel theater. It was reflective of the time, but was it really sensitive? Did it really enrich the culture of people that it portrayed?
No, it simply supported the dominant.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So you have to understand, you know, the context behind that. And I think a lot of this, too, is about big britches. We're talking about people like Beckett and Mamet and August Wilson, people that have kind of like are like the upper maybe creme de la creme echelon of American playwright theater. And maybe they're like, well, I'm this and I'm, you know, ain't nobody touching my stuff because I'm this person. Mm-hmm. You know, I think ego has a lot to do with it. Yes.
Sure. It does.
But so there's another question.
I also think that the way we do theater has changed so much. Like the classics, what we call the classics, I don't think it was ever thought about how those pieces would change over time, not to the extent that theater has changed now.
Yeah.
So Leslie, you and I talked about this before about voice, authentic voice, and how doing sort of color conscious casting, if the voice is not an authentic voice, then what are you actually doing by imposing that on a different race to speak? That was very ineloquent, I apologize. Like we talked about finding a world where there is a heightened language where it's not anybody's voice, it is so much easier to do colorblind casting because you're unified around trying to achieve, like Shakespeare, like nobody speaks like that anymore. And so we can all join together to speak like that. And it doesn't matter what color, what religion, what, you know, any of that stuff. But for instance, there was a production of Trip to Bountiful by Horton Foote at VCU done by the undergrads that was consciously cast with an all black cast. And the play was originally, it was done on Broadway with, Cicely Tyson. So Cicely Tyson did it, and actually Horton Foote's daughter okayed rewriting of the script to adjust some of the language. So what happened at VCU was they didn't do that, so they made all of these actors speak the words as they were written, and a lot of the reaction of people who saw it said, wow, that's an amazing play about race. The play wasn't about race at all. It was about an old woman who had been sort of peripheralized and wanted to go back to what mattered to her. So is there a way to sort of, because that's a universal experience. That is not a black-white experience. But Horton Foote's language was so essentially white. That's a real conundrum, right? And Dr. T, whom you know, Leslie, is always talking about authentic voice. And don't make somebody fit into something that isn't theirs. Anyway, I'll shut up now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we talked about this before, as a playwright myself, I definitely hope that whatever I write and put out there can change with time. Mm-hmm. But my problem as a playwright is when you have to change my words to fit your casting.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem for me. Like I wrote those, I painstakingly wrote those words. I bled over them. You know, don't just change it just because you found something in it that you think could be cool for someone to see. Like that's not okay. But I'm wondering if not only is some of this ego for bigger playwrights, but is it something fundamental about how we do theater in this century that is changing?
And
we want to take all of these classics that don't fit how society works or how society looks, and we want to make them fit.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about that more. We're going to talk about classics. We're going to talk about, you know, your writing being your baby and how much you want people to change that, all that good stuff. I can definitely talk about that. This is Homegrown. Drop! It is 18 minutes past the hour, and if you are just tuning in, this is Homegrown, your local show about art on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We are having a special roundtable discussion at this episode of Homegrown. Bree Luck, Boomy Pedersen, Scott Dunn, all in the hizzy, talking about the extent of the playwright's role in production. This is how we do it, Homegrown. So, before we went to break, we were talking, Leslie, you were talking, you touched on, you know, the play kind of being your baby and how you don't really want people touching your words.
If how we do theater in this century has changed to the point where classics are no longer going to be something that we can really rely on to do, because when they were written, they were so entrenched in their time period, and does that mean that we try and make them fit, or do we not do them?
Well,
or do we do them with the understanding that we're going to lose a certain audience demographic because it doesn't speak to everyone?
Well, I think we need to do more work that speaks to our time and how it is changing and the embrace of it. I was talking with a good friend of mine that I see a number of plays with, and we spoke a lot about the a lot of misogyny and a lot of domestic verbal abuse, especially in things like Death of a Salesman and Fences recently. And let's be real, they're not friendly plays towards women. There was a lot of assault and rape, especially shows with domestic assault on women written by male playwrights. Yeah. So I think that says a lot about the culture that we live in. And I think there need to be new playwrights, female playwrights, queer playwrights that write about their situations and put that into the ether and let directors mess with those types of themes and those types of cultures and those types of places, because that's what we need to be doing. We need to be changing the culture. We need to be making new classics. So that's where I'm at on that. But going back to how far that extent of that creative control goes, back to the point of, this is your child, essentially, that you are putting into this world for people to observe and to ooh and ah and to build upon, and not necessarily impede the theme that you're trying to create, like you were talking about. And, you know, I wanted to present that Albie's spokesperson makes a point about how this particular character is a blonde character that has references to his blonde eyes and blue skin in this production. Blue, yeah, you know what I mean. Blonde eyes and blue skin. That's a horrible, that's a frightening looking individual. I mean, I love everybody, but I would be taken aback at first sight. But what I'm trying to say is that, again, are you making the play different than what the playwright intended? Yes, it may be racially insensitive to do so, but devil's advocate, Hitler's lawyer.
The question is, if you produce
that's not
that
my joke, I can't
knowing that there is that Aryan, quote-unquote, character in there, isn't that also a statement about race?
Yeah.
You know, do you have to change the race of the actor playing it and change the playwright's words to make that statement? Couldn't leaving the words and the actor the way the playwright intended make the same statement?
I think it could certainly make the same statement, but then I think that you are changing the integrity of the piece. And you know, I'm a director, I'm not a playwright, so there's part of me that I want to honor the playwrights, and I completely respect that Albie wanted to have that kind of control over his plays. But as a director, I also think, well, this is an important story too. And you're right; it is changing the integrity of the piece. But it's telling another story that could also be valuable. You look at Katori Hall's recent production of The Mountaintop, where they cast
two Martin Luther Kings, one white and one black.
Yeah, and she was really worried about this. And then the statement that I read from her said that she really. That she got so much out of seeing both actors playing the role, and that it made a new story for her, and that was exciting to see. So there's also part of me that says, as a director, I think it's also important to be able to re-envision things and to look for the other stories that can exist in there. But when you have a playwright like Scott who says, I want my play to live on, I want it to grow, I want it to evolve, I want other people to interpret it in different ways, then you can take more license with that and do that. When you have a playwright like Albie who says no, or Mamet who say no, this is how I want my work to be shown and these are the stipulations that I put on it, then...
Yes, so Scott, you and I talked a little bit about this like a week and a half ago, and you brought up the point that you think a little bit of this is definitely based in ego of these playwrights who are used to being at a certain status level. Specifically, we were talking about Mamet.
Yeah, with his bit about the not wanting a talkback to be held, you know, within 2 hours after a performance of his play, I thought that, I forget how I put it exactly, but he's, to me, that was his ego talking, and there's really no bones about it. I don't see any reason why you need to restrict a conversation that theater is supposed to inspire following a play, and no one has to stay for a talkback. But for those people who don't have an opportunity to otherwise get to talk to the actors, or if the director's there, or if the designers are there. And so we had a talk back for Death of a Salesman a couple weeks ago, and because I was stage managing that show. And so we had almost the entire cast on stage, which was a somewhat diverse cast, you know, thankfully. And so, and we had the director on stage as well. So we had an audience of about 20, 24 staying after to talk. And those are the people who want to have that conversation and maybe don't have that opportunity outside their own homes. Who, you know, and
right.
Then get to talk to the actors. Like, what was it like building this character? What was it like playing this character? We had the family next door were cast, to the Lohman family, were cast as African-American, which was a different take than the original casting of the play. And so, that dynamic, what that created within that play was an interesting shift, an interesting look, and what that was. And we talked a little bit about that at the talk back afterwards. So, but it was definitely definitely different from what that felt like early on. But I think with...
Well, and it's not like a playwright can really stop people from talking about it. I mean, no. Whether it's organized or not, I mean, if you go to a show with, you know, three friends, you're going to go out for a drink or dinner afterwards, and you're going to talk about what you just saw. Yeah. Like, I'm kind of perplexed as to what... And the time limit is what really perplexes me. Like... You really think 2 hours is going to make a difference as to what someone says or thinks about what they just saw? Like,
people might forget.
That just really confused me.
Then they'd have nothing to talk about.
Right.
Well, I think the article that
well, and you know, the last play that he opened, you know, bombed. Like it was open for what, a week, and nobody came. So I'm wondering if it was just Solid him trying groups. To hold on to that status that ego. He believes he has.
The article that I read about it said that he was in favor of discussion. It wasn't discussion that bothered him. It was the sort of formal discussion of a talk back. That a talk back can feel, I'm misquoting it, I'm sure, but it was something along the lines like an awkward classroom experience. And, you know, that may or may not be. I like our talk backs. I think they're a lot of fun. But what I read was that he was in favor of the model of doing exactly what you were talking about, Leslie, which is going with your friends to a bar or to a restaurant or going and spending time together and discussing it in an informal, more humane and connective way than perhaps a formal talkback. But that's not happening with the actors, and it's a different kind of an experience.
I wanted to bring up the whole idea of community versus professional, because I think that's a huge element. So the production of Death of a Salesman that cast African-Americans in the Uncle Charlie and Bernard characters, in the world of the play as envisioned by Arthur Miller, would never have happened. I mean, in 1947? 1947, you would not have a young black man going to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court. That just was not going to happen. But because they were community members and because they had identities beyond the characters, I actually really appreciated seeing that. I'd seen them in other shows. I'd worked with them. You know, so there was a whole different element of... why having them in the show worked for me. It wasn't that I reevaluated Arthur Miller's play, because I didn't, because it is what it is. But I appreciated the community element of it. And I think that's really important, because I think theater needs to be more and more and more about the community in which it is created. And I think that's part of what we're saying, is let it reflect where we are, who we are, and change. We make the change. So if we want our communities to change, we have to start by doing what we're doing in our communities and changing. So, I mean, that's sort of nonsensical, but you know what I'm saying. So we're not handicapped by, oh, you can't do this. It's, oh, no, we can. And maybe it's not going to change what the message of the play is, but it's going to give a different visual message, which I think is really important. And if people get used to seeing that different visual message, then maybe it'll spill over into the rest of our society, right?
Yes.
All right. So we're going to do another drop, and then we're going to come right back with this roundtable. This is Homegrown. Drop! 32 minutes past the hour. If you are just tuning in, this is Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is your local show about art. Bree Luck, Boomy Pedersen's got done in the house. Talking about playwrights, talking about roles, talking about productions. And that makes sense.
You brought up the point of community theater being separate from professional theater. So do you think that the role of community theater changing how we view theater pieces and how audiences perceive them needs to move towards professional theater for them to kind of adopt that philosophy? Or do you think they're totally separate?
Well, let's just talk about the economic factor.
Right.
I don't think you can get away from that. I mean, a $25,000 fine for not adhering to pre-show contract about talkbacks, I mean, that's all about the money.
Yeah.
I think that professional theater is, in many cases, it's a job. Professional actors go from job to job to job. They're not interested in staying in the community. They're interested in making the money. For those of us who live in communities, we can wish that we got paid, but we're not, it's not why we're doing it. So I think it is very separate. And I think that in, so this goes to new playwrights too. The professional theaters will do new plays by known quantities. Mm. Community theaters have the possibility of doing plays by unknown playwrights. And the more they are done, maybe the more they will go out and be done other places. So I don't know, Bree.
What's your take?
I mean, one of the things that I love about being involved in community theater and being involved in many community theaters over the years and being the artistic director at Live Arts now is that we can grow and reflect. We can grow with and reflect our real community, and that's a real gift. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I'd love to see people like Clinton write plays that we could do in our foundry show.
Yeah, we'd like to see that too. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yep.
Go ahead.
And I'm gonna do a little plug for our foundry program at Live Arts, which is really, which is it's low budget, right? It's like, it's low tech, no sets, minimal costumes, minimal props. It's really about the stories and the people and truly about our community taking risks, whether that's writing their own plays or trying out new techniques or taking a different approach to a play that might not be the same kind of commercial, have the same kind of commercial viability that a main stage show does, but really focusing on creativity and art in our community. And so that's where I go with that, Boomy.
Yeah. And I think with that being said, and I think we only have like a minute and a half, but community theater has the harder part because there are some plays that they honestly do try to get, you know, some butts in the seats, like Death of a Salesman, like Rent. I think Live Arts has Hand of God coming up, which is a Broadway, a new Broadway success. So it's like, they have an obligation to not only get audiences in the door, but also do good by the community by putting on multicultural, color conscious shows that embrace, you know, the entire culture of the community. And I think that's really respectful of the people that are sitting in this room and the other people who are not, who are probably listening to this and being like, David, shut up. You don't know anything about theater. I really appreciate you all in my community. So, yeah, any last words before we break out of here, guys, playwrights?
I'm just going to go
closing
home
statements.
So.
Keep writing plays.
That's right. Keep writing plays.
If you want to, Scott, if anybody wants to write a show about a kid from New Jersey who finds his way to Charlottesville and grows up and in a world of countryness.
I want a show for David.
Yeah.
That's a David exclamation wants to write that, point. Needs to be a musical.
Let me know.
Sure.
Black guy, 5'7".
Bring it to Playwrights Lab.
No. Bree Luck, Boomy Pedersen, Scott Dunn, thank you so much. Leslie,
thank you so much from
Memphis. And we are going to now... Here are just some of the artistic events happening this week. Currently running through June the 11th, American Shakespeare Center. Spring season featuring Two Gentlemen of Verona and Romeo and Juliet by Shakespeare, and also Thornton Wilder's Our Town and Anne-Marie MacDonald's Goodnight Desdemona. Good morning, Juliet. At the Blackfriars Theater in Stanton. And now through June 30th is Dallas photographer's Janine Mishnabale's exhibit, her collection Through Darkness to Light. Photographs along the Underground Railroad at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. June 15th, Eyes on Art Tour that engages people with Alzheimer's disease and meaningful discussions about art. Also, June 15th is Big Blue Door Improv Night at the McGuffey Arts Center. June 16th and 17th, don't miss Jefferson School African American Heritage Center's 2017 Juneteenth celebration featuring ceremonies, tours, and music by DJ Flatline, Big Lane, Yolanda Coles Jones, Jamal Milner, and more. June 13th, it's Writing Love at the Charlottesville Writer House. Instructor Anna Corman leads a seminar for prose writers in both fiction and nonfiction who are looking to make vivid the feelings, all the feelings, joyful and otherwise, of love. Also on June 17th, Neil Perry writes Writing Nature, leads Writing Nature, a seminar that will explore the ways poets can use and have used the natural world as a guide, a prompt, an antagonist, and an inspiration in poems, also at the Writer House. Also on June 17th, UVH Braylon Art Museum presents Telling Tales with Tiles, age-appropriate tours with hands-on art activities that make the museum's exhibitions accessible to children. June 24th, Polly Lazaron and Lisa Ellison Coast lead Embodying the Muse, a seminar that looks at how physical practices like drumming, dancing, and yoga can invoke the muse at the Charlottesville Writer House. And for your music options this week, noon, Central Virginia Blues Society has an electric jam at the Batesville Market. This afternoon, Jenna Matthew at Glasshouse Winery. June 13th, Travis Elliott at Fellini's. June 14th, on the Downtown Mall, we have Daryl Rose. He leads an African drumming tour at noon. Devin Sproul leads a women's flash mob. What? In the song I Can't Keep Quiet at 12:30. Latin Dancing Showcase by the Dance Spot at 1. Albemarle High School's A3 House Art artist Anthony Huang performs live saxophone layered through a digital looping station with breakdancer Colin Adams at 1:30. Charlottesville Ballet Academy at 3:30 doing select pieces from their repertoire. Eli Cook at 4. Jazz Jam with John Durth at 4:30. Oh my god, the Downtown Mall is lit this afternoon. That afternoon, or June 14th is going to be late. June 15th, the Michael Ellswood Gathering, and then Nick and Stephen Pollock at Fellini's. June 15th, David Tewksbury, Brianna and Matthew, Bobblehead, Paolo, Emilio, Frano, and Curtis Prince, and the Clairvoyants play a benefit concert to raise money for Alzheimer's research at the Ante Room. June 16th, the Judy Shops play Fridays at 5 at the Spring Pavilion. June 16th through 24th, Victory Hall Opera presents Drug Song, music by Rickard Wagner, and script and direction by Jen Hoyt Tidwell at UVA Brooks Hall. June 16th, J-War and Vibe Riot EP release at the Ante Room. June 16th is also the Jaunty with the Blenders and Tequila Mockingbird at the Southern Cafe and Music Hall. Also Love Cannon at the Jefferson Theater. June 24th and 25th is Love Fest, Music and Art Festival at the It's Art Park. June 24th is Evan Mooks and then Randy Johnson 3 with Jonah Kane West at Fellini's. June 24th, Johnny B and the Goods at Batesville Market. June 24th, Shaquille Mockingbird at Tin Bushel Irish Pub. Every Monday, Seafoot, Charlottesville Friends of Old Time Music. Weekly open jam at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Unitarian Church. Every Tuesday, traditional Irish session at the Tin Bushel Irish Pub. Every Wednesday, open mic at Pro Renata Farm Brewery. Also every Wednesday, Jazz Collective at Fellini's. Every Wednesday, the night Mike Rosinski and Deaf Quartet, Miller's. And every Thursday, John Durth Quintet at Miller's. Yeah. And those are your music options and art options and theatrical options for all this week. But first, Leslie's still on the phone.
All right, Joe. I'm going to
No, you're not.
Sign off. We're
what?
Getting ready to head out to our first museum today.
Okay.
Y'all have a great rest of the show.
Okay.
Love you. And I'll
we
see
love you.
Next week.
All right. Enjoy Memphis. Go Grizzlies,
bye.
I guess. Take it easy. All right. That leaves me alone with Mr. Brian Wimmer. Headspace, Majordomo. He's heading up the Love Fest at the Music and Art Festival. The Music and Art Festival at the X Art Park, June 24th and 25th. Brian, I've heard and seen so much about you, and I have yet to talk to you.
Well, let's talk.
How's it going, brother?
That's going awesome.
Good to have you here. So tell us about Love Fest.
So Love Fest is, this summer marks the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love, which was 1967.
Right on.
I was born in 1969, so I missed all of this very interesting.
But they were practicing.
I might have been a product of some summer of something. It was a transformative time. It's kind of interesting right now. It's not the same things that were going on, but then it was civil rights, Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
People were kind of going a little bit crazy, and something happened at Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, and it kind of transformed a generation and the generations to follow. It left a legacy, and it started actually with a lot of BNs and things like that at San Francisco's parks, and then there was a concert called Monterey Pop. And this was a famous concert because it was one of the first times that audiences got to see Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Janis Joplin came on a major stage there, Otis Redding.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the first times he hit the stage. And there was something, and it catalyzed things. It was also Ravi Shankar. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you were getting different musical influences. Mm-hmm. But eventually 100,000 people descended on San Francisco, young people, and created this sort of legacy of flower people and flower power and what that was. And to me, I see people kind of fighting each other right now. I mean, we're kind of dealing with stuff here in Charlottesville, all sorts of conflicting ideas. And some people are going about it in the ways that they want to deal with it. And I run the Ix Art Park, and we're all about possibility there. And I want to see that power of possibility in being productive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have an opportunity. I said, hey, let's have a concert. And this thing got crazy.
That's awesome. And actually, I want to say, I've been in Brooklyn for about 6 years, but since moving back last year and seeing the Ix Park and what it is now, it's one of my favorite places to go to just like hang out and just like chill in those gazebos. It's a great place to like watch family and their kids. I've seen a lot of great shows there. Every time I see like you guys and what you offer to the community, you offer like a wide array of like, shows and, you know, just sit-ins and just things that you wouldn't necessarily see anywhere else in Charlottesville. And I just want to say I appreciate that, and I appreciate the opportunities that you give to the public here in the city.
The key word there is opportunity, because I can do a lot of weird stuff. I'm a filmmaker. I'm a creative. But for me, I value a lot more what other people bring to the park. Mm-hmm. The park's just a place. But once it gets occupied by people who want to bring different things to it, whether it's a theater piece, Boomy has brought plays there, whether it's a repair cafe where people are volunteering time to fix other people's vacuum cleaners and computers and things like that, whether it's a hip-hop show, whether it's Sivo Sabroso, which is a Latin American festival. These are the things, to me, which really explore the breadth of the Charlottesville cultural community. And to me, culture is the key. Culture cures everything. Culture is identity. Culture is the past, but it's also the future. And really, at the end of the day, culture's what makes life worth living. It comments on our day-to-day troubles, but it's also culture's food, culture's music, culture's dance. Culture's what brings people together in a non-political, non-controversial. If you're going to go have a dance, like salsa dance is great. You're going to trade partners every different song. And you're just going to enter to, hey, now I'm dancing with an old person. Now I'm dancing with a young person. Now I'm dancing with a whole breadth of people. So the more that we can bring people together for food, for dancing, for music, and really show that we have a shared history and a shared identity, and even to broaden that and say, wow, for Sivo Sabroso, we're going to see what Honduran culture looks like, what Bolivian culture looks like and feels like and tastes like. The more we can do that, the more we can realize that we're all on this planet to enjoy what each other brings to the party.
With that being said, I mean, you did highlight a word, which is culture. And what I'm noticing personally, and this is not only in Charlottesville, but kind of on a national scale, is that culture that you put on at your park so greatly is being threatened by, you know, groups and factions and, you know, an administration, you might say. So with that being said, don't you, does that threaten the culture and the appropriation of culture and all of these, does that worry you? Does that worry the diversity that you can offer?
Culture will always be here. And even what we do at the Ix Park, it could disappear tomorrow. It could. But to me, we focus on the process. Culture is what's happening now, right now. So culture is this conversation that we're having. Culture could be you having, you know, breakfast with your kids right now. So for me, we can look off and worry about what's going to happen, or else we can just focus on what's happening now. And to me, I have this opportunity with the park. We're going to have a concert in 2 weeks. That's 2 days of possibility.
Nice.
And it's going to be what happens then among those people. And it doesn't matter what happens a year from now. Summer of Love created a legacy, but things got worse afterward. After the Summer of Love, Martin Luther King was assassinated. After the Summer of Love, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Vietnam got immensely worse. Nixon got elected. Summer of Love didn't solve anything, but for a generation, it allowed them to live within possibility. And we're still kind of living out the legacy of that. The Occupy movement owes a little bit to it. Even right now, the notion of indigo children owes a little bit to that. Even like our notions of where music went and what music does. And that music was music of songs of protest, songs of possibility and love. That was Mamas and Papas and whatever. All these things were anthemic to our times. So, and I'm kind of curious now what music is going to say about our time. So within this thing, some people are doing some covers. Actually, something kind of amazing happened. This is the power.
I was going to say, talk about some of the music acts that are coming down to Love Fest.
So this is the power of possibility. I wanted to have somebody cover The Age of Aquarius. It's a crazy weird song. By the way, Hair was also written during the Summer of Love.
Yes.
This is the dawning of
So that song was written by the Fifth Dimension. Fifth Dimension was this kind of crazy, super optimistic band. They also did Up, Up, and Away in Your Beautiful Balloon. You're like, what? Where did that come from? So I was
going to... They got the EP in here in the Classic Station. With, I want that outfit that brother's wearing, too. That shit's crazy. It's got, like, black and white. No, right. Go ahead.
So Age of Aquarius, I was going to see if I could get, like, a gospel choir to cover it. I had some other options, and I ran into Remy. And he's going to do a hip-hop cover.
Nice.
Of The Age of Aquarius. And I'm just like, that is amazing.
Yeah.
So there's
gonna work.
Rochelle Claiborne, who used to sing with Soul Sledge. And just like, wow. She started singing it. It's like, I don't know if I can hit that high note. Maybe if I can go low, you know.
Yeah.
When the moon, I was like, oh my God. Okay. And that is just 10 minutes of about 21 hours of straight music. We have 40 bands. I went a little stupid on this because I wanted to include everybody.
Yeah, this is a fest, baby. You want to fill it up.
So we've got all genres. We've got Mighty Joshua coming. We've got a band, Black Masala, who does like weird gypsy punk stuff. We've got a lot of local bands, tons of local bands, from singer-songwriters to folk to world music.
Okay.
Beleza's going to be there. They're going to cover
Is there a website
Santana.
Where we can like catch all the whole program and the information?
LoveFestSeville.com.
LoveFestSeville.com.
There you go. And you can get tickets on there. It is a ticketed event. I couldn't put on 40 bands without making this ticket.
Oh, I was just going to walk down there and jump the fence.
There you
go. That's cool.
But it's getting big, and what I found out too was there's music. There's all this music. You know, there's old music like Jimi Hendrix. Somebody's gonna do some covers, stuff like that. But there's also new music that you're gonna hear. And I'm like, wow, maybe a new anthem is gonna come out of this. But there was also the notion of, well, what else happened there? So in the mornings, actually, aside from the thing, we're gonna do meditation and yoga and things like that.
Okay.
There's gonna be an after party, a love lounge. We're going to have like a love nest, a love shack. We've got a lot of nonprofits coming, a whole food court. We're going to have stuff for kids. It's very family friendly. To me, it's also, I come from a little bit of Burning Man background. And the notion there is not, I paid my ticket, go ahead and entertain me. I'm going to sit back and just watch. No, you're going to participate. And to me, that's what culture and potential of possibility is. what happens when other people come? So I want people to come and paint themselves up and dress crazy and to really involve themselves, because that's where we get community. And I'm like, wow, I think, and people are like, well, you know, you're going to have a fun little concert. I'm like, no, this is a possibility of transformation.
Right on.
You go to Burning Man and you come back, you're like, I think I'm a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and again, we get down to Love Fest. Why love? Love is a really, it's kind of a corny word, like love. I'm talking about love. I mean, but love, the Greeks talked about like eight different kinds of love, like friendship, like love of everyone, love of your mother and your father, self-love, long-standing love. There's a really neat kind of love called ludus, which is playful love. It's like flirting. Mm-hmm. And that often moves on to eros, which is a little bit more romantic love. Mm-hmm. But let's look at all those different kinds of love in a day. So now, and actually here's a really cool thing. I ran into somebody the other day who does the, I think they do media worldwide for Yogaville. And the deal was that their yogi, he was the guy who opened up Woodstock.
Hmm.
And he's passed away now, but they said, hey, maybe we can do something and help open up your Love Fest. Because
nice.
It was the notion of, hey, because it gave an intention to the time. And it isn't to say this is all going to be a bunch of hippies and crunchy granola.
No,
this is like contemporary.
Yeah.
Love
for everybody.
Yeah. So what is your definition of love? What is your idea of a love fest going to be? Because it's like right now, mm-hmm. we could be in the middle of a hate fest. And we see that happening. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to be a place where people come together, where we put that aside.
Same.
And we see what kind of a community we want to live in. And we create that community now. That is that possibility of now, when culture is now.
Mm-hmm.
And can love be now? And it's weird to really ask ourselves, what if we lived in a community that was always about love? It sounds a little weird, but it's a place that I want to live in.
I agree with that notion.
Yeah. So we have great, but hey, it might just be a party. I don't know. But that's what a possibility is. So possibility is about the people who are listening right now. To be part of that possibility. Don't let somebody else, don't wait for somebody else to tell you what to do to make it happen now. So that is the invitation. So again, go on to lovefestseaville.com. You can see our lineup, and also you can get tickets. But also, the one thing too, the tickets are $25 a day, $40 for the weekend, but we can let you in free if you volunteer for 4 hours. So we wanted to make it acceptable and open to everybody.
Yeah. So if you want to come down to Love Fest, if you plan, you were planning on coming down to Love Fest anyway, and you want to help out, mm-hmm. you know, boom, free ticket, four hours.
Yeah.
Just hang out at a booth.
There you go.
Serve out some drinks.
All that good stuff. I mean, we got set up to do, because that's the other thing. How big could this be? Well,
right.
I know you want to build something, you want to paint something, mm-hmm. you want to lead a workshop on something. Give us a shout. You can usually get a hold of me at info@ixartpark.com. That'll come directly to me. Got an idea. I would love to hear it. And it's not just for that weekend.
Right, right.
We've got a whole summer. We've got a whole year. And how about making that possibility happen all year long?
All right. So what's coming up after that? What's
yeah.
before Love Fest, after Love Fest? What's going on at
Ix? Before Love Fest.
I mean, we've been talking about some stuff.
We're going to have a couple workshops. We've got like a tie-dye workshop and a hula hoop workshop. Actually, Kristen Bowden and Joe Lawler are going to play the 23rd. The weekend, actually, this upcoming weekend, a young woman, Athena, who does some really interesting tarot card reading and yoga and other sort of kind of, I can't even describe it, but she's going to lead a love vibration workshop. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is, but I want to be there, definitely.
But I'm all about love.
Yeah.
And you're always about love, and we appreciate that. Brian Wimmer heading up the Love Fest Music and Art Festival at Ix Art Park, June 24th and 25th, sponsored by 94.7 WPVC.
Yeah.
The Progressive Voice of Charlottesville.
Yeah, and actually, can I just mention that we have a Crutchfield has been very good in helping us out. Brown Auto has been very good in helping us out. Three Notch Beer. All these people, they're helping us put on this thing. So give them some love, too.
That sounds like the dopest car ever. Crutchfield, Brown Auto, and Three Notch.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Brian Wimmer, thank you so much for coming to Homegrown.
Thanks for coming and having
me
on.
No problem.
Okay.
Love Fest. Go there. See things. All right. We're just about to end it up. My man Clinton's got the hair queued up. Clinton, man,
I'm mad because you left me hanging in the water with all of these theater dramaturg sharks just preying on my ignorance. Like,
man, I left them in good hands. What you talking about? What you talking about? Left in good hands.
Suffer and burn. I guess, well, since Leslie's away, I guess I don't have rehearsal today, or I do have a rehearsal. I have a table reading. I don't know. There's 800 Google Docs I need to look at this weekend anyway, so it's no problem. But stay tuned for your Sunday morning wake-up call with your host, Sean McCorn. Their guest is Jeff Fogel, talking about what moved him to run for Commonwealth Attorney, recorded before Fogel's recent assault. Yeah, that's what he got. Yeah, he caught one to the face because Jeff Fogel's for the people. This is also your reminder. On Tuesday is June 13th. That's when you can vote. So if you're not registered, be registered. If you ain't voting, you stupid. Go out and vote on Tuesday morning. Stand in front of there if you need to. Leslie was here. I speak on behalf of the lovely Loquacious Lascivious and Leslie M. Scott Jones. Thank you to Bree Luck, Boomy Pedersen, Scott Dunn, Brian Wimmer. You guys were awesome. Yeah. Love for your community. Love your community. Protect your community. Hold on to your community. This is David Von Strahn. This is Homegrown. We are out. Peace.